Welcome back to Future Thinkers. Today we are continuing with our regenerative series, and our guest in this episode is Richard Perkins. He's a farmer, educator, and expert on regenerative agriculture. He's the co-owner of Ridgedale Permaculture, which is one of the few profitable permaculture farms in Europe and on the planet. Richard is dedicated to restoring ecosystems and educating people all around the world in profitable regenerative farming. In this episode, we talk about what permaculture is and how to get started with it, what sorts of mindset we need to have when we deal with complex natural ecosystems, restoring rites of passage for young people, and how to apply ecological principles in business. To get the full two-hour episode, become a Future Thinkers member at futurethinkers.org/members. And for all the links and show notes in this episode, go to futurethinkers.org/128.
We've also recently mentioned that we have some really big changes coming up, and those changes are now here. We've just launched our brand new members community at Mighty Networks, and we're really excited to share it with you guys. It's a great platform for bringing our community together and having all of our courses, our calls, our groups all in one place. The community is a space for collective insight so you can transform yourself, upgrade society, and regenerate the earth.
The second big thing that's happening right now is we're currently in negotiations with several potential partners and a property for our regenerative center / smart village in Canada. And we've already received our first investment for it. The place is in the Kootenay region of British Columbia, and we're really excited about the progress that this project has made since we moved back to Canada. If you want to get directly involved, you can join us at futurethinkers.org/members. We have a special group there for the project where we've been posting regular updates and doing weekly group calls. And if you're not familiar with the project and you'd like to check out the vision for it, go to futurethinkers.org/center.
And finally, our workshop on generating archetypal mind states with Michael Taft has been going great, and the participants are learning a lot. The video for the first part of the workshop is now available in the members area, and the second one will be up shortly. So if you want to sign up, go to futurethinkers.org/Taft. All right, let's get into this episode. Hey, this is Future Thinkers, where we talk about how to adapt to a changing world, build more resilience, upgrade culture and society, and create meaning and purpose. With your hosts, Mike Gilliland and Yuvi Ivanova.
I got into agriculture. I left home at 15. I was quite young and vulnerable at that time. It was a pretty difficult time of life. I was from quite a large family, and I think I was a little boisterous for my parents, and I got edged out at a time when I really needed support. And I actually ended up living with a very strange community of Romani and Irish travelers, Gypsy people in the UK, and they'd been settled down together by the local council, and they're peoples that perhaps don't normally live together or mix. And so I had I grew up very fast, from quite a naive, very studious child to being exposed to things that perhaps some people should never be exposed to, you could say. And it was a pretty intense period in my life, but an amazing period, because it just opened my eyes to so many things. And some of the Romani people are incredibly skilled at living on the land, and they taught me how to catch rabbits with newspaper and how to poach the sea trout in the rivers and how to put a wood stove in, all these practical skills of how to look after myself. And these are people that's, like one of the old men nearly severed his thumb chopping firewood, and he just ran to the field and chewed up a herb, stuffed it in his cut and stopped the blood flow, and all these little moments that just totally reconstructed my idea of what it meant to be looking after yourself and to be resilient, and also a sense of community, which is, you know, they're quite a repressed people. And it was at that time that I knew I wanted to farm. I wanted to live on the land. I didn't know exactly how I wanted it to look, but I knew I wanted to live with the land and off the land. And I'd been brought up with a great appreciation of nature and simple living in some ways. But I remember having a conversation with my girlfriend at the time and a few other couples, and we were sitting around, and I spoke about that vision and that dream, and I said, I'm going to buy a farm when I'm older, and we can all, I had some vision that we would all live there and we'd all be like happy couples and live our lives together. So I took that dream, and I think they perhaps took it as a joke or a nice vision, but I actually had a seed planted in me through that time. And I went to agricultural school when I was 18, which is not the life pathway my parents would have expected, I guess. And no one in my family had been a farmer as such, but I grew up in a farming community. So I did HND in organic crop production, like organic horticulture and crop production. And that was okay, but it was quite basic academically, and I was quite advanced at the knowledge they were sharing. So I left after that and started traveling around the world, looking for better answers than the agriculture school could show me. Because basically most sons and daughters of farmers spend all their time learning about how to fix very expensive machinery or how to apply the correct doses of different chemicals. And for me, that's not farming. That's the job of a technician. I wanted to do something a little bit more organic and a little bit closer to the patterns of ecology that I could see around me. And so I went on a journey that I've been on ever since, looking for pioneers in their fields who have found ways to mimic how nature raises livestock, nature grows trees, etc., to produce valuable products for local people, but to run a thriving business at the same time. And that's really been the key for everything we do in our work, is that it must be benefiting the land and leaving it in better condition, and it must be benefiting us and making us a good wage, and it must be good for the people consuming our food. Otherwise we wouldn't obviously have a customer base. Like, we need to produce excellent food that's better than what you can find in the store. And that's what we've really set about to do at our farm here in Sweden in the last 7 years, and it's gathered a lot of attention, because it's like, hey, here we are in the middle of the country, and we can earn a Stockholm wage, and we're totally managing our lives. We're growing amazing food of all different kinds, and it's an old style farm in that it's diverse. We have meats of different kinds, we have dairy products, we have eggs, we have vegetables, we have wild things that we gather. It's like we have a whole human diet on this little land. It's 25 acres, so that's 10 hectares, which wouldn't be classed as a farm in today's world. It's, you know, maybe a homestead for some people, but we can drive 4 or 5 full-time salaries off that, working 6 months of the year primarily, which is amazing. And then we get a long winter rest where we can go travel or we can do other things. So
that sounds awesome. You know, what's most impressed me about watching your videos, and I've been trying to watch as many as possible to get ready for this call, is that you are very open about the business side, and you talk about all of these different projects that you've got running. I'd like you to talk a bit more about that, just because our audience is probably not super familiar with you yet. Like, what do you have going, and how do you manage your time between all of these different projects?
We'll unpack that a bit. So my work's been heavily educational, and I set up this farm in Sweden with 2 different directives. One was to create a profitable farm that rebuilt the landscape and recreated habitat for the things that we farm amongst. And the other was to educate and inform and empower other people how to do the same. So I took on the responsibility to collect massive amounts of data and all of records and to document it so that I could say, hey, you know, how do you build a little slaughtery for a chicken so that you can do this work on your farm and earn the money for the work you did, rather than sending that off to a middleman who then makes all the money? Because most farmers in your country, my country, are 65. They can't get out of farming because all their capital is locked up in infrastructure that can't be moved, and young people can't afford the land or to buy them out, so they can't get into farming. And if you follow that on logically for 2 generations, we lose all the knowledge of real tangible skills. And so my foremost like educational principle has been, I have to be able to show that this is a life worth living. Otherwise, why would a young person, especially in a country like Sweden where we have such high social standards, why would someone come to live in a relatively rural place to work incredibly physically hard unless they could actually make a really good living and raise a family doing that? And so for me, that's been a key point. A lot of the sort of alternative agriculture space has got a lot of great ideas that don't fit the triple bottom line that we managed to. They might be great for the environment. They might be great socially, but they don't make money, so they can't be sustained. So for me, that's been the missing point in a lot of the places I visited in my younger years. It's like, this looks great, but it's funded by the government, or it's funded by this scene. It's like, we need to be able to drive it as a business, and we need to also educate the public, because food is, I think, the same way you are. It's people are spending like less than 10% of their expendable income on food. And so that's changed dramatically in the last 50 years, where people would have spent 40, 45% on their food. And there's this, you know, very quick rotation of products in today's marketplace, and food is very undervalued, and we expect stores to be full of food all the time. But hopefully this COVID situation around the world has highlighted that to people, and actually all the people I'm speaking to in my field are seeing their sales are doubling, tripling this year, as more and more people suddenly become aware, like, hey, there is no food in the shop, and hey, where is that food from anyway? So actually our profession has become much more successful in this year, whereas most businesses are struggling. And it's sad in one way, but it's very hopeful in another way, that people are paying attention to those sort of questions. So going back to your question, I set up this farm with three primary businesses as such, which were, we produce vegetables as like a CSA, so people will pay up front for the year and receive vegetable boxes throughout the year. And then we set up with pastured broilers, so that's a meat chicken raised outdoors, moving every day on pasture, that produces something of exquisite quality that you can't buy in a store here. And probably everyone's aware of factory farms and the horrible conditions that things are raised in. And then we produce eggs from pastured laying hens. So they're a different type of chicken that's more focused on producing eggs than big body mass. And they have their little chicken houses, and they move around every day onto fresh ground. And so we're trying to copy how nature does things. So we have, like, if you've ever seen a postcard from Bali, where you have like a water buffalo, and on the back of a water buffalo, there's always a white bird. And that white bird is the sanitizer of the pastures. He'll go around and eat the little insects that are annoying the fly, annoying the water buffalo. And so we mimic systems like this. We take cows and sheep, and they act as biological lawnmowers. They cut the grass in front of the chickens so that we can put the electric fence up around the chickens to keep them safe. And then the chickens spend their day scratching through little cow pads to get the omega 3 and 6 rich maggots from the flies that would otherwise later come and annoy the cows. So there's all these little beautiful synergies that we can take from nature and apply them to our production systems. So we're not just trying to make money, we're trying to rebuild a habitat at the same time. So we planted a lot of tree systems in the farm, and we've started to see many species coming back to our farm. We've got three pairs of nesting birds of prey that have moved on to our farm. And this is a tiny little bit of land, but all the surrounding landscape to us is monoculture spruce plantations or empty pastures with no animals at all. And so we've become like this little island of activity where creatures want to come and live again. And this year, after 7 years, it's full of tiny songbirds. And when I first came to Sweden 7 years ago, I didn't hear a single songbird. And I really noticed it, because in England, where we have lots of very small gardens and very tight, dense population, you have thriving songbird populations in those gardens. So I really noticed that change over time, and it's been amazing to witness. So how do I manage time with those? Well, one of the main things that we do is find optimal ways to make workflows for everything. So standardization of practices. So everything we do in the garden is standardized. All of our vegetable beds are exactly the same size, and they're designed around the hand tools that we use to work them. And that means all the sort of greenhouse covers or covers that we put over the crops to stop insects. Everything fits everywhere. So every procedure is standardized. If you're taking a crop out to put another one in, you have four different tools you're going to use, and it looks the same every time. So you then, like what I do in my educational work is I'm training people to go off and start their own farms. So we go through all of these procedures on the farm, and I get them to test in their own experience, like, what are you capable of? And I set benchmarks, like, here, I can process a chicken in 25 seconds, right? So this is my hand movements, right? So watch real slow, now you copy. And now, okay, do 10 and get faster and get faster, and find that point where you know you can handle, because then we can make a business plan. If you know you can handle this much in a day, I can tell you the input costs, the output price, whatever. We can adjust it for your country in Germany, whatever. And now we can formulate an actual recipe that will work in your time, place, and circumstance. So obviously farming doesn't look the same in different countries, different climate zones, but we can adapt to... I've worked in all the different major climate zones in my consulting work in the past. So one of my main jobs is connecting people to those different aspects of workflow, time management, business planning, so that we can then recreate that plan for their circumstance so that they can go off and start in a successful way. And what's interesting about that is most of the people that come to our farm for educational reasons have come here because they can't find the answers they're looking for at agricultural school, because they just don't teach those things. And they often teach you really poor business management, like massive debt-based infrastructure costs that you don't pay off for 20 years. And most young people don't have that mindset where they would want to invest in that way. And so all the enterprises that we run are designed that you pay off the investments in the first year and make money. So it looks like a very different ball game than farming did a decade or two decades ago. And the use of social media and all these different skill sets that, you know, typically farmers all over the world are people that don't like actually talking to people, not very communicative. But now with the powers of social media, etc., it's like you can create products and you can put them on sale right in front, direct to the customer immediately. So we've been promoting various models for direct sales to consumers, because this is the basis of food security. Is if I know you and your family and you come every week and take food from me, we have a relationship, and it's very hard to break that unless I do something really stupid. And it's, for me, that's the sort of community I want to live in, is a community that people have a relationship with the producers of their food, because then when times are hard, people come together and support that rather than just turning away to some other place. And so there's sales models that we've been promoting around Scandinavia that are spreading now to America, South Africa, and I think Australia even, where that's been systematized too. So we will take like a typical week like today, we just... two people have gone off to deliver about 5,000 euros of products. We'll have the same tomorrow. And that drop-off takes about 1 hour in the summer. So this is a Facebook-driven direct consumer-to-farmer sales group. And so we meet them in a car park for 1 hour, and all our customers come. There'll be 200 customers in that time picking up things they've already paid for. So we don't stand at a farmer's market all day. We don't have to sit in a farm shop all day. We turn up for 1 hour, drop all our products, and we come home. And it works because we still have chores to do when we get home. So a lot about time management is finding efficient workflows and optimizing processes for minimal movements. Because farming is essentially moving stuff from one place to another. That's really what we do all day. So it's remembering to take something with you when you go over there, or leaving things in the right place. And a lot of interesting things have come out of applying the lean principles that were behind the sort of Toyota Motor Company and the amazing success story there. But lean is really well applied to farming, and that's all about eliminating waste and maximizing, optimizing workflows, etc. So that's a big part of how we fit in a lot into what we do. And then another key aspect of it is that we're very clear what we're trying to do. We've defined the context of this place very clearly. So decision-making isn't a big challenge. We don't spend a lot of time making decisions because we're very clear what we're actually trying to achieve. And so we don't sit around having meetings trying to work out what to do. We know what to do with all these processes. And so it's kind of a well-oiled machine. We're just carrying out processes. And because of the massive amount of data collection and record keeping that we've done, including time and motion studies, etc., it's at a level now where we can really cruise with that. And we can also help other people to set up in that way too. And a lot of people have gone off from here and set up amazing businesses, which is, yeah, it's really great.
The brand new Future Thinkers members portal is now live. Develop your sovereignty and self-knowledge with our in-depth courses, get access to our weekly sense-making calls, join the Q&As with past podcast guests, and much more. Become a Future Thinkers member today at futurethinkers.org/members.
Yes, yeah. It's really amazing to see how you've integrated so many different aspects. You know, you're talking about efficiency. At the same time, you're talking about regeneration of the land and bringing back biodiversity. You're talking about regenerating communities that, you know, those long-term relationships directly with the people that you're working with and serving. It's, I don't know, it seems very integral, you know? You're optimizing those things on all the different levels of kind of personal and interpersonal and different levels of relationships. I think that's amazing. I haven't really seen anything like that before.
I appreciate the integration of technology as well. Like yes. The fact that, you know, these farmers are older. They're probably not on Facebook. They're probably not thinking about, you know, web-based subscription business models and that kind of thing. I'm interested to hear what other kind of integrations with tech that you're using.
Well, there's different avenues in that because so one business I run is the farm and the other business I run is education and communication of those things. So I've written a couple of books and offer online trainings and we have a YouTube channel, etc. So a big part of that has just been communicating out information. And so my channel it's become very popular in this sort of niche of the farming world, but it's not highly polished YouTube videos. It's about, hey, here's information. If you want raw information and you're happy with second-rate video, because I'm crawling underneath an eggmobile with chickens shitting on me, and it's like, I don't want to bring a camera. I just, you know, it's got to work on my schedule, as it were. But there's something real and honest about that that people have really enjoyed. I'm not trying to gloss it up. It's like farming is hard work. It always has been, but it can be done well and smart in a way that benefits the land and people and ourselves. And so we've used digital communication a lot. That's like our main tech part, and that's to communicate that vision to inform and empower others. And it's really, I mean, I get a lot of feedback that people are starting their businesses based just on watching videos. And that I don't separate things into separate categories. I just document whatever feels inspiring for me at the day. And it takes really no time out of my life. And I've always wanted it to be that way. I'm really willing to share and give information, but I'm not going to spend half my day producing it. And so there's people that have waded through all that and used that to basically set up their business, which is amazing. Obviously, we do more intensive focused education, and so media is all part of feeding into that too. And yeah, the other elements of tech are we're using like some old-fashioned ideas married with new tech. So some of the tools we use in the market garden, for example, just increase workflow capacity like 10x, 50x. So we have this little battery-powered, you know, like a battery-powered screwdriver that has a brush that goes around with a razor blade at the bottom. And if I have a bed of lettuce leaves or spinach or something, I would used to have to sit with a knife and harvest each plant. And for a 30-foot bed, that might take you 20, 25 minutes. With this tool, you stick in your cordless drill, it's done in 2 minutes flat. So you've just like 12 times time saving. And if you start doing that across the board, it turns a full day's work into a half a day's work. And then lives are manageable because everyone knows like a farming work week is not 9 till 5. It's like whenever needs doing, you know. Cows escape at 11 at night, it's time to go. So what we're trying to do is achieve, I think a farming week is 50, 55 hours. That would be a decent target for people. But that's quite a big ask for the youngsters that I'm sort of mentoring into this field. It's like most people aren't used to that anymore. And one of the issues I've seen with a lot of younger people today, and I'm whitewashing a whole load of people, but I'm speaking quite generally to the people I meet coming here to take in training, is people in the sort of age bracket up to the mid to late 20s are, I feel, really in a very different generation to myself. Like I grew up without smartphones and internet wasn't really a thing. And so it's really become noticeable to me, like some of the things that I hold dearest to my heart of what makes society great, like discipline and commitment and living by your word, seeing things through, etc. Those are the qualities that you need to succeed in this work. It's like there's no one looking after you. It's like if you don't put the work in, and that's the same with any business in some ways, but with farming, it's starkly apparent because it's, you see that action and reaction very directly every day. And it can be a real shock for younger folks who I feel are more removed from that in their upbringings. You know, a generation or two ago, it would have been very, you know, everyone would have known someone in the coal industry or something like proper hard graft. And I feel like youngsters today get it pretty easy. And there's less value in hard work or discipline or those things. And for me, they're really actually fundamentally important to the society I want to live in. And so that's a big part of, I don't know how that relates to technology, but I guess it's our interaction with technology works in an outreach way that brings people here. And then part of my job is reconnecting them to old values that I think underpin rural communities and working communities. And it's what we all want. We'd probably all say we all want good food. We all want meaningful work. We all want to, you know, sleep well at the end of the day and be healthy and close to loved ones. But to actually do that and make that a reality involves going back to some of the old ways of doing things because they were what created and sustained that in a truly deep way. So yeah, so we have technology on the ground in terms of modern tools that make things really efficient, but we have all this social media that allows people to leverage both the selling of produce and connecting with others to feedback information and tips and expertise, and the ability to reach out and add on other businesses to such a business, you know, which is, yeah, it's really great. It's a lot easier to bring people into the farm than it would have been in the past. And I think that's a really important thing for kids and for families to be able to actually go onto farms. Like most farms have signs that say, danger, it's a farm, keep out, right? But it's really important for kids to, like, we always have open days, hundreds of local people come, and it blows kids' minds, you know, to see the things they eat in front of them and to be able to touch and feel and taste. And, you know, we're living in a country where the kids at school think the milk tanker comes to fill up the cows.
What? Yeah, actually, you're answering the question that I was going to have next, that it seems that with this COVID pandemic, there's been a resurgence in interest in localism and in understanding where your food comes from and food sovereignty and people wanting to grow their own food, or at least wanting to buy food from somebody they know who grew it. And I was going to ask what advice you would have or sort of tips you would have for people to get started with that. And you started answering a lot of that really well. I appreciate that you talk about the mindset shift. Like it's a different way of thinking and a different way of living as well that people have lost touch with. Like, it's not just about like, oh, how do we, you know, buy from a different source or how do we consume differently? It's also about something that you do and participate in, which I think is really, it's something that's being really overlooked in modern societies. How do we actually participate in things? What do we bring to whatever we're doing? So I'd like you to sort of talk about that a bit more, about the participation and this, I guess, maybe permaculture approach to how do we work with things rather than I'm over here and this thing is over here and it's an object.
An extension to that would be, for me, that what I'm interested in is knowing how people change and where people are resisting that change when they first come to the farm and when you get to see them for the first time. What's surprising for them?
Well, that's quite a different question. So maybe take it as a separate question. Because see, well, the thing about, like, one thing I see about the way consumerism works today is that people don't, they're removed from any sense of responsibility. And that's probably a downfall of the digital era. It's like people can be totally removed from everything. Like, in one way, we're so connected. In another way, we're totally unconnected and don't need to take responsibility for anything. And I had an interesting journey through looking at alternatives to community. But I always felt they were very contrived and rarely, I could rarely see the potential for them to last more than a generation. Certainly historically, the examples I saw hadn't. But what I started to feel was like the things that people are looking for in those spaces are the things we all want, and we can only have by choosing them in our unique time, place, and circumstance. I don't want to live in an alternative village over there that isolates itself, actually. I want to live in a functional village. So what's a functional village? Well, it's one where the farmers are in the middle of the village. They're like, you know, this whole idea of community-supported agriculture. It's like, well, what about agriculturally supported communities? Like, the farmers should be the rock stars driving the fancy cars around. Now, I'm saying that tongue-in-cheek, but it's a good point. It's like, why aren't we celebrating the people that produce the very lifeblood of the people, the kids, in our village? But for me, I need to see everyone empowered in their own roles. We need empowered bankers, empowered shop clerks. We need, like, everyone doing their bit. And so for the consumer, it's like, well, you need to do your bit too. It's like, the simple idea of what you vote for with your money. You know, when people really track their money and take a log of where they spend their dollars, it's amazing where that money ends up when you really think about it. And, you know, I guess you're from a part of the world where it's horrendously sad how diet and products have affected the mainstream health. I mean, it's part of the worst places on the planet. And luckily here in Europe, we have more historical culture around food, more importance put on it. Although I grew up in England, which doesn't seem to have a cuisine, and now I live in Sweden, which is similar. But most of Europe has, you know, there's a lot of heritage around food. And so I think there's a massive increase in health and nutrition interest, right? And that's really what's driving a lot of people to look at agriculture. If you look at some of the big podcasts, like things like Joe Rogan's podcast, you'll see like regenerative agriculture has been mentioned on there a couple of dozen times in the last year. And they've even had Joel Salatin, one of the world's most famous farmers, on there a few times. But I think that interest has come from the health and nutrition movement, which is much more directly and personally linked to everyone because it's easy to get your head around. like farming's just too abstract and over there for most people. They're not connected to it at all. And it's overwhelming and perhaps scary because it's the world out there is chaotic and or chaotic. It's not something that someone that's grown up in a city can understand intuitively because it doesn't fit any of the sort of pattern language of what they've grown into. And yeah, I'm not sure if I'm answering your question. I'm just thinking out loud in a way, but I feel that like people need to ask themselves what they want for their own health and what they want for their kids' future, and it's their money that creates that. And obviously the driver behind cheap food is going to be hard to overcome. But one thing I would ask people to consider is like, well, can you afford to eat cheap food? Because the main comeback against good food is that it's expensive. And it will only ever get cheaper if that market expands, but it's also hard because you're paying the true cost of production. So most food is produced by migrant workers or machines, subsidized by the government. So basically, most farming on the planet in Western countries is run by businesses that don't actually work. They're funded by the government and they wouldn't work without the funding. And so you're not, you know, those consumers getting cheap food, but at what cost? Well, at the cost of massive soil degradation. So you eat about 450 kilos of food every year, but agriculture destroys 10 tons of soil to produce that every year. And that's being funded by the government through your taxes to destroy habitats. We've heard of bee decline and insect die-offs and all these things. They're the result mainly of farming. I mean, we move more topsoil around every year through farming now than the last ice age moved in its entirety. Wow. And when you really stop and think about that, it's huge. Like plows, machines get bigger every year and destroy soil quicker and quicker. And every culture that damaged its topsoil became extinct pretty quickly. And we're doing that faster than ever. And we've got the state now where 7 out of 10 of the biggest rivers on the planet don't flow to the sea year round. And so, hang on, 7 out of 10 biggest rivers don't flow to the sea year round. So that's like really a symptom of something that's past the tipping point, you could say. You know, you only start to see those symptoms when things are quite far in their processes. And so, what I'm advocating is a return to more resilient towns and villages and cities where there are hundreds of small farms running maybe individual businesses, but interdependent and complementary businesses to each other. And that's kind of how we don't do that so actively, but we do that through our sales. So we sell through this Facebook group called Rico that I was saying about. And so we've gone to find like the baker and the fisherman and the miller who makes bread and flours, and there are dairy people. And so we all come together. So you can literally sidestep a supermarket and buy your whole groceries from only local producers. And they're all the sort of people where you can go to their farm and they will say, hi, I'll show you how I do. And that's the sort of level of community that is resilient, and people work together and support each other and help each other.
What do you notice as far as the change when people first come? Like, and where's the resistance too? Like, do people actually change, or do they just want to go back to their old way of doing things once they figure out how much work it is to have a farm?
Okay, so you're talking about people that come for education. Well, let me answer that in two ways, because in terms of consumers, so following on from what we were just saying, in terms of consumers, they rarely turn back when they've had good food. Like our hens are, like if you eat real eggs from hens that have moved on pasture daily, they're nothing like eggs you can buy in the store. Now we sell them at the price of organic eggs in the store, but those organic green box eggs with a picture of a happy chicken in the sunset, they're just from a mass-produced organic that, you know, it's slightly better than non-organic, but it's still mass-produced industrial farming. It's not people who have an intimate relationship with the animals and the landscape around them. They're just huge houses full of birds that are fed organic feed, not inorganic feed. But when someone tries that food, I mean, we get people sending us photos of their fried eggs and their omelets and their souffles, and like all the time people are sending pictures of their food all the time because they just, they love it, and so they'll never come back to eating rubbish food again. And as long as we can maintain it at an affordable rate, it's going to work well. And what we found is all the products we sell are in line with organic mass-produced food, so they're not more expensive than industrially produced food. And we don't have any subsidies at all. And so that's proof of the pudding, as it were. In terms of the people coming here for education, most, like, I'm working with people who are dedicating their lives to this as a career. So they've already chosen to go into that. But I would say our farm has become quite prominent as a stepping stone or a springboard for people who are really just about to go off and settle on to their life project. And so it's a testing ground, and it's a place where they can try out many different things in one place, because we have a lot of different enterprises on one farm. So that's partly to expose people to many things in one place, because typically when I was growing up, you would have to go and study one thing over there and then across the country and see this thing over here. But when you don't see these enterprises working together, you miss the interaction between them. So in the winter, we have our chickens in the greenhouse that's empty from the tomatoes in the summer. And that makes us a deep compost that goes back on the vegetables in the spring when we put the tomatoes in again. And all of our enterprises work like this. So we have all this cost and waste from this thing going as a product and input cost for that thing. And that's the beauty of having many different enterprises in one place. So a big part of what I was doing with the plan of this farm was to design the sort of place that I wished I'd been able to find when I was learning, because it was very mishmashed. It cost me a decade and probably 100,000 euros of traveling around the world and doing training with people and, you know, trying to find out a bit of everything. And so I think when people come here and get exposed to that, one of the most interesting things that happens is they come here with a fixed idea of, I'm going to be a market gardener. I want to grow vegetables on the edge of my town, and that's what I'm doing. And then they will fall in love with raising poultry and go off and set a business up doing that. And that happens more often than I would imagine it would. It's surprising. So that can be really helpful. It's like a big part of what we're doing is looking at psychology and context clarification, value clarification, as well as decision-making, business planning. And that stuff is really undervalued and underlooked. Most people have got a lovely, cute idea of, oh, I'll live outdoors, grow some vegetables. And it's like, well, that's quite easy. Growing vegetables is easy. Running a business while managing a family and having a baby, that's tough. So it's like, so let's cut out that bit, look at this bit. And by the time we've been through all that and really, you know, put the numbers through the ringer, it becomes obvious to them that they could meet their life goals much easier in this way. And so that's really great. And then on the flip side, sometimes people get the reflection back that they can't handle this. You know, they want to be up at 9 o'clock every day in the morning. It's like, no, farming doesn't work like that. It's like animals need to move at 6 in the morning here because the sun is up super early in the summer. It's like you don't get to set the rules. You're working with a natural system and you're putting animals in fences. You just elevated their care above your own. It's like, it's not time to sleep in, it's time to go start work. So that occasionally people realize they're not made for it, but most of the people that come to our education programs they already know those basic things. So they're, you know, they're coming with a higher level of experience. So
That actually also answers part of my question before about participating with the system rather than trying to impose your own rules onto it. I think that in that there's a seed of what's wrong with how we interact with nature and how we can do it better.
Oh, we love to impose ourselves, don't we? And we love to fight symptoms, not core problems. And so if you think about our education or our financial system, our political system, whatever it is, it's like we love to fight symptoms and manage reactively. And that's how all institutions and governments on the planet today are run. And it fails. Every time in history you look, that will fail because we're dealing with complexity as farmers. So you could say in system science, you have hard systems and soft systems, right? So a hard system is complicated, like a mobile phone or a space rocket or a computer. It seems complex if you don't know about these things, but it's not complex at all. It's a hard system. It's complicated. It's made up of lots of things that you press that and it'll go bing, and that's all it does. And that means if it goes wrong, you can diagnose what's gone wrong, fix it, and it'll work again. But with farming, we're working with, or ecosystem management, whatever, we're working with all soft systems. And soft systems are defined by things that evolve in ways you can't predict. So economy, ecology, society, they're all complex by nature. And the trouble with making decisions in the face of complexity is that you will have unintended consequences as normal. So think about how we employ some of the best brains on the planet. We have too much CO2 in the atmosphere, so why don't we come up with a way to fly a rocket in space and disperse little mirrors to reflect the sunlight back in space? What could go wrong with that, you know? And it's a symptomatic, that's how we deal with it. We fight symptoms, not the core problem. The core problem is that nearly all the carbon in the atmosphere is actually from the soil, not from burning fossil fuels. It's at least equal, maybe more, is from topsoil. And what happens on most of the world's surface, about 60% of the world's surface was grassland covered in millions of animals. And those animals were removed because we shot and ate them, or we had 50 years of range science that said animals cause desertification. So we took all the animals away and it got worse. And what happened across most of the world's surface is you had grass plants growing 3, 4, 5 meters tall with roots going down that deep too. And wherever roots of plants are in the ground, they put out sugars. So they're photosynthesizing, capturing sugar, and then they're pumping that sugar into the ground to feed microorganisms who then make the soil anaerobic, like no oxygen, because they're so excited and they're reproducing and feeding. And that change in the soil chemistry releases the nutrients the plant needs right outside the cell wall where it can take it up. So wherever plants can root, you have living, healthy soil, and the main component of living, healthy soil is carbon. So sugars going into the ground from the plant, that's carbon. It's short-chain carbohydrates, polysaccharides. Also, what happens when a cow comes along and eats that grass plant is now the plant has to release some of its annual roots. They die back because it has to balance its hydrology. It must balance the water within its system. Just like you're 70% water, a plant is 70% water too. So it needs to balance that system. And when it sloughs off its roots like that, that turns into long chain stable carbon that lives in the soil for thousands of years. That's where all that carbon that's now up in the atmosphere came from. You've got desertified regions across the States, across Central Africa, across the Middle East that were once thriving grasslands covered in, you know, you can read back reports when the English landed gentry would go to North Africa, sit on an elephant and shoot 4,000 or 5,000 gazelle in a weekend for pleasure. But can you imagine, like, the biggest scene you might have seen is National Geographic and there's 4,000 wildebeest running by, but what about 40 million, you know? Like when Europeans came to North America, there were 60 to 100 million bison running around in the herd. And that's what kept the grasslands alive. So if you take the animals away from the grasslands die. There's been so many ecological studies like this. You take one species out of a rock pool, the whole rock pool collapses. So you can't mess with any element of ecology without upsetting the whole. And that's what we haven't understood. We've had a rigid compartmentalized, linear, reductionist approach, and that's how we still run governments and economic systems, etc. But hopefully it's becoming more and more apparent to people that we need to think in whole systems, and many of us already do, but our governments and the policymakers are not yet thinking in those ways, and so they will continue to fail because unintended consequences will continue. And the beauty of this type of farming, when we really look at it, is we have all the solutions for cleaning air, cleaning water, producing food, restoring nobility back to land stewardship. And we have all those solutions. We just need a lot more people doing them. And the only way to do that is to show them that you could make a really good life for yourself. Not just a livelihood, but a lifestyle also, you know, and that's, so that circles around to what we set out to achieve here.
Yeah. And, you know, when you talk about governments doing things in a linear way and eventually it fails, like it's a self-terminating system, sometimes it does have to fail in order for people to reconsider how do we actually do it. And we're seeing a little bit of that now with this COVID thing where, you know, the way that the governments reacted created unintended consequences, and now there's riots and it made a bunch of things worse. And now people are like, nothing is the same. Okay, so what do I actually want to do with my life? And they're actually starting to consider these alternatives, living closer to nature, living closer with the food that they eat, closer with the community that they interact with, actually belonging to a place rather than just residing in a place.
I think so many younger folks are totally disillusioned with, you know, what they're being presented with, and the media becoming more and more clearly, you know, out of sync with reality. And there's a huge drive for that. But I think there is also, there's quite a lot of cushy alternatives also that people, you know, shy away from physical work. It's not so common now. Like, most young people don't actually have tangible skills anymore, you know? Like how to fix an engine, or how to shear a sheep, or how to gut a cow, or like most people don't actually know how to do that. And like, I always get surprised because I have to sort of calibrate with the team or our employees that we have, or people on education. I have to try and quickly tap into where their thinking and skills are, because I'm assuming they probably know how to do something that I've done since I was five, but they might never have done that before. And yeah, I don't know what I was going to say about that, but it's, there's a lot of people looking for alternatives, but that's where they need a reality check also. And I think it's not the sort of, this type of farming is not the sort of job for someone to, like, it needs a level of observation and engagement that you can't find in someone that just wants a job and then goes home. It's like, it needs someone who's really stepping up and is engaged in the world around them in a very different way. And the irony is that, like, it's very hard for us to find employees because we're essentially training them to go and start their own farms. And they do. And that's, it's amazing to watch. But it's been interesting for us because it's very hard to train people to the level that's we want to be having consistently in our team, because they're the exact type of characters that will go off and do something for themselves. So it's an interesting one, but that, therefore it's necessary to have places like this that are specifically for powering people up to go and take that jump, because there's not so many places they can find that. I think there are some in the States, certainly some dotted around Europe, but there's not enough, and agricultural schools are not ever going to supply that need, because what you see if you look at how institutions work is they must run on public opinion, so they're always behind the leading edge. Like any university or institution that's run in that way has to be. And if I think of all the important inspirators and people I look up to in this field, none of them went through formal education. They're just people out there on a limb trying stuff in their own experience and watching very carefully. And so that's this big dilemma in the field of farming, is that most modern farming is not about farming anymore. It's about being a technician sitting in a tractor all day, and you need a PhD and a laptop just to drive the tractor, and you never even touch the soil with your hands. It's like, you know, it's a totally different world to that. So
Yeah, it's interesting when you talk about these kinds of life skills that used to be life skills that now people are so removed from. I guess my background is a little bit different. Like, I grew up in Russia in the 80s when things were really bad, like the government was collapsing and there was no food in stores. And so out of necessity, we just, you know, bought a small plot of land and grew everything we could on it, you know, all varieties of vegetables, fruit. We had some animals, like basically as much as we could pack onto this tiny piece of land. And we had to do everything ourselves because there weren't any, like, you know, services where you could go and get things done. Yeah, like butchery or whatever. We did everything ourselves. And it was really rewarding. And then, you know, moving out to Canada after that and seeing the stark difference where people are just so removed from all of those things. They don't actually know how food grows, or they don't know how, you know, the life cycle of an animal. Or even their own life cycle in a way. Like, people are disconnected from their own health because they think about health as like, which vitamins am I taking? Or like, how many times a day am I exercising? Like, I need to go to the gym, or like, oh, I need to try the keto diet, or I need to try the vegan diet or whatever. Like, they're not actually connected with how their body is responding to all these different things. And it's kind of this, like, it's an ideological approach rather than a practical approach where you're actually doing things and observing how things are changing and tweaking things based on that.
You know what else is funny is, like, you know, having run the podcast for a while, and we're now in like this pre and post COVID era. Like, we saw this desire for meaning and for something tangible and something real before COVID ever hit. Like, people asking us, you know, to ask our guests and as well, what should I do with my life? Like, what can I do that will have meaning and have impact and do something good for the earth as well? And like, everything you've described kind of ticks all those boxes. And yet there's this barrier of like, oh, that's a 50-hour work week. Oh, I didn't want to do that. Like, but it hits so many things, like the exercise and fresh air and nature. Yeah. and knowing where your food comes from and
community.
Yeah, health, exactly. Everything. Just everything.
Yeah.
And I hope
somewhere to raise a kid, you know.
Oh yeah, totally. Yeah. Yeah, there's just so many things. The community aspect, I would imagine, would be pretty great there as well. Is it for you?
Well, I mean, I want to go back to the question, but I could say that the COVID thing's been very interesting in Sweden because Swedish people self-isolate themselves anyway. That's part of the Swedish culture. I think over there you have a quite contorted view of Scandinavia. And I've seen a lot of pieces written about the idyllic Scandinavia. And it's not like that at all. Like, there's a lot of problems and people are quite repressed here because, you know, it's just a place where people won't push boundaries and they will, it's assumed, like, I haven't seen a police car in 7 years. Wow. Because you don't need one, because, like, I've never locked my house, don't even have a key for my house. It's like, it's a different world because everyone falls in line and doesn't challenge the authority. And that's nice on one level, but it's extremely oppressed in another level, psychologically. And being a Brit, you know, it's quite interesting for me because we're a bit more bolshy than that. But I think, I want to go right back to Russia because I think there was a huge proportion of the country's food was able to be grown in the country, right? And we've seen that in wartime eras in, you know, London and big cities like that, that cities could produce their own food if they actually used their green spaces. We saw it in Cuba when the embargo was put on. You know, it's like there's no doubt we can produce food and meaningful work and all of those things. And the thing about the 50-hour work week is like, well, to do the other work I've been doing, I've probably done 100-hour work weeks. But I'm not just running a farm. I'm educating people and I'm writing books and producing a lot of information. So it's, you know, I'm choosing that. I don't need to do that. And I'm choosing less and less to do that because I'm getting gray hairs. But the biggest thing I could reflect back to someone is like, yes, we work physically hard and we work fast. We're not just idling around. I mean, we're moving all the time and people can see on the YouTube channel what that looks like sometimes. Some of our work processes, it's like dialed in to be hyper efficient. And so we're working hard, but we're playing hard too. And the thing is, the line between work and rest and play becomes so blurred that it's all one. It's like it is a lifestyle in that way. It's like, yeah, I get up early every day, but I've woken up at 6 every day for 10 years anyway. It's like I'm always awake. So I go and start my day. And it's actually the nicest time of day. It's quiet. The animals are calm. It's beautiful and sunny here in summer. And like going and harvesting 50 kilos of wild berries and mushrooms is like, is that work? Or is that fun and play? It's like I'm learning more than any educational institution could ever teach me about all subjects. And the beauty of this type of farming is that one minute I'm a plumber, then I'm a butcher, now I'm a horticulturalist, now I'm a carpenter, and then I'm a chemist and a biological physicist making compost or whatever. It's like I don't, you know, there's no limit to what skills and avenues of knowledge and thinking you can go down. And what I've noticed in my own journey in re-educating myself is that as I learn holistically, knowledge that I learn in one field translates to all other fields. If I learn something about how forest ecology works, it translates to using money differently. Now that might sound really abstract, and it is a bit abstract, but that's been my experience of the education I've been through since leaving school, is that I've been learning in holes. And I see, how does nature invest? How does a tree invest in its habitat? And what happens if you invest money like that? And that's very interesting, but that's maybe a whole nother book that I'll write one day.
Okay, that's it for this episode. To find all the links and show notes, go to futurethinkers.org/128. To hear our full 2-hour interview with Richard Perkins, become a member at futurethinkers.org/members. This is where you'll get access to our courses, our group calls, guided meditations, workshops, and the group for those working on the Regenerative Center with us. And to sign up for the Michael Taft workshop, just go to futurethinkers.org/Taft, T-A-F-T. See you in the next episode. If you like this content, you might want to check out our 7 Ways to Adapt to the Future guidebook. Get it for free at futurethinkers.org/signup. You might also want to check out our Future Thinkers membership area. We have courses there to help you adapt to the changing world, build resilience, upgrade culture and society, and create meaning and purpose in your life. As well, you'll get access to our community, all of our unreleased content, private Zoom calls, live Q&As with guests, workshops and events, and more. Just go to members.futurethinkers.org. And if you enjoyed this video, please like, share, and comment. It really helps out our show more than you know. And if you want more like it, then subscribe and hit that bell icon to be notified of new videos. See you next time.